Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
If I have not had a chance to meet you, my name is Noah. I am one of the elders here. You may not recognize me a lot. I typically work on Sunday mornings, and so I'm a little spotty back and forth with my church attendance. So go ahead, before we even get started, take a second and just internalize the fact that one of your elders here said he doesn't attend church Sunday mornings very often, okay? Just let that sit. Think about what you're thinking, the judgment you're sending my way, okay? And during this sermon, I'm going to send that right back at you, okay? And you're going to have to deal with it, okay? So, as you've been tracking with us, we're going through the book of Mark. Last week, Kyle talked, and the main thrust was he was talking about how do we relate with God? How do we interact? What do we do there? And how do we relate? So, before we jump into our text, I've got a question. I think I only have two questions for today. And I preface it every time just because I preach somewhat infrequently. I'm going to have a couple questions that I'm going to want a response from. So the first couple are super easy. The last one's harder. So get the easy one so then you don't have to do the hard one, okay? But the first one is, what is the best vacation spot? If you're going to go, you're going to go on vacation. What's the best vacation spot there is? Yellowstone, Cannon Beach, Disneyland. Why is Faith in here? What is going on? Disneyland, get out of here with your Disneyland, Faith. Sorry, that was my daughter. Where I'm going to talk about Disneyland. Where else? Spain, Hawaii. So here's what you're hearing, man. We've got mountains, national park, hot place. You've got activities, right? Everybody has their different idea of what the perfect vacation is. We actually just, Kyle, Rob, and I, not that long ago, we even had a conversation about vacation. The question kind of came up, if you had like a month off, what would each of us do? So you may or may not know, right, the three of us are pretty different dudes. And so Rob can find joy in a vacation with activity. He even talked about Disneyland. You heard my daughter talk about Disneyland. My wife has said, hey, we should plan a trip to Disneyland. I have this list of stuff I'd rather do than go to Disneyland. And the idea of going to Disneyland and say, okay, you're going to take time off of work, we're going to spend a bunch of money, and you're going to go to Disneyland, sounds like one of the worst ideas that I could possibly come up with. But some people would say, man, that's my perfect vacation. All of us have these different ideas about what that is, but there's really the same reason why we go on vacations, and that's rest. We all want to find rest. We just find rest in different ways, right? Rob talked about with his vacation, he talked about Disneyland or going out and doing things. Kyle talked about, man, I'd want to go into the mountains for like a week by myself. And my answer was, I would never leave my house. Like, I'm always leaving my house. If I could not get into my car to go somewhere, man, that sounds awesome to me, right? A super different spectrum of what we would do to find rest. And if Rob took my vacation and stayed in his house, Lisa would leave, and he wouldn't find rest during that week. And if I took Rob's vacation, I would need a vacation after my vacation so I could recoup from it. But we're all trying to find this idea of rest, and how we do that's very different. But God actually set up rhythms for us of rest. We have daily rhythms. We need sleep. We have weekly rhythms, right? The Sabbath, which is what we're talking about today. And we even have yearly rhythms of vacation. In the Old Testament, I think there might have been up to 7 festivals that God established for the people of Israel, week-long vacations, right? Your boss probably gives you maybe 2 weeks. God's a better boss. He had these rhythms in the year of knowing our capabilities and the fact that we run dry, both physically and emotionally, and we need breaks to then be refreshed and refilled to continue going. He knows that about us, and he actually set a law, one of the 10 commandments, to say, you need to take a regular rest. And that's what the Sabbath is. I think it's super important to talk about because in our culture, we're not good at resting. Everything's busy. We're going. We're on our phones. We're rushing around. Really, in my mind, the only thing I can think of, there's one group that is actually good at resting in our culture. Do you know what that is? Firemen, exactly. No matter what is going on in their lives, they take at least 20 days off a month. They're the only ones I know of that are good at resting. The rest of us are like working in things, and we're not good at taking a rest. So today, in our passage, we're going to talk about the Sabbath. It's in Mark chapter 2. It's beginning in verse 23. We're getting into some passages in Mark that are super confrontational between Jesus and the Pharisees. And there's stories that we'll see where it almost feels like Jesus is specifically picking a fight with the Pharisees. And then we also have passages where it seems like the Pharisees are just specifically trying to pick a fight with Jesus. And it's like they go back and forth with each other. Well, today, the Pharisees are trying to pick a fight with Jesus. So starting in verse 23, it says this. One Sabbath, he was going through the grain fields, and as they made their way, his disciples began to pluck heads of grain. And the Pharisees were saying to him, "Look, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" And he said to them, "Have you never read what David did when he was in need and was hungry? He and those who were with him, how they entered the house of God in the time of Abinathar, the high priest, and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and also gave it to those who were with him. And he said, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath." So we got to talk about what's going on here. And Jesus pulls in other references and stories that are happening here. But we have this weird sense that the Pharisees are like walking behind Jesus and his disciples almost. Like, we don't have a timeline. We don't have an idea if someone was watching the disciples for the Pharisees and then went and like told on them or something. We don't know exactly what the scene is. It seems kind of weird. The Pharisees are just there. So the disciples are cutting through a field. They're hungry and they're grabbing some grain with their hand and they're eating it. So we want to explore a little bit about why this is significant for the Pharisees. And I'm going to read a few passages because I want you to see that, right, we don't make stuff up here. We look at the Bible and we read the Bible and we use the Bible. So the first one is Exodus chapter 20 in verse 8. And this is the section where God is actually laying down the Ten Commandments. And we get to the Sabbath commandment. And what's interesting is some commandments take a few statements for God to declare. Some are kind of single liners. But in the Sabbath, it starts in verse 8. "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock." The cows had to take a Sabbath. "So, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy." One more verse to explain, to set the scene for what the disciples are doing. It's in Deuteronomy, and it's in chapter 23, and in verse 25, there's a provision for how people interact with each other. Because what we see, and we'll talk a little bit about laws today, but what we see is there's some really big laws that God laid down, like the Ten Commandments. And then throughout the Old Testament, there's a lot of little laws that he set up. And a lot of it was just how to basically live in community with each other. We have some of those same things now, right? This is how you behave in polite society. And we have laws in all our culture that are different than other cultures' laws. Just like here, God was setting laws for the people of Israel that were different than other cultures around them. But a lot of them were how to interact with each other in community. This provision starts in verse 25, and it says, "If you go into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the ears with your hand, but you shall not put a sickle to your neighbor's standing grain." So what's happening here is the disciples, they're on a walk, right? Jesus took them on walks all the time. They're going through some grain. They're hungry. So they know by law, even though they're in someone else's field, there's a provision for someone to be able to just grab kind of a handful and eat some to satisfy their hunger. They're not taking a sickle to it, right? You're not stealing from someone's field. There's a law allowing them to do this. But the problem is, it's on the Sabbath. So this is what the Pharisees are upset about. So the Pharisees viewed this as actually working, threshing grain, which seems silly because they're just kind of grabbing a handful as they go. What's interesting is the Pharisees had a lot of definitions of work, 39 definitions of work that you couldn't do on the Sabbath. And there's really, really big ones like you can't go out and thresh your grain, all the way down to you cannot spit into dirt. It specifically says you could spit on rocky ground, but if you spit into dirt, your spit could go into the ground and provide water for a nearby plant, and they deem that working to provide water for a plant. But if you spit onto rocks, nothing's going to live from that. So you can spit and not be work here, but if you spit over here, it's considered work. And if they saw you spitting into dirt on the Sabbath, you were violating one of the laws. So we hear that, and you're probably rolling your eyes at how ridiculous that sounds, because it's ridiculous. But before we go on, I want to take a second and think about the Pharisees, because typically, I think we read through the Gospels, and we almost think about watching a movie, and it's almost like here's a good guy versus a group of bad guys. Right, maybe you think of it like the best Christmas movie ever, Die Hard, and you've got one single good guy in this building against a huge group of bad guys. So now we've got Jesus is the good guy, and we have the Pharisees that are the German terrorists. Okay, this is how I read my Bible. It's exciting when I read my Bible. Okay, so Hans Gruber is leading the Pharisees. He's watching the disciples and Jesus, and he's trying to pick a fight. And we get to watch. We get to kind of step back and go, oh my gosh, when's Jesus going to get a machine gun? Well, he doesn't, unfortunately. But we get to sit back and watch this. But in reality, we're not viewers. Even when we read the Bible and we think about 2,000 years ago when Jesus is walking around, we actually aren't that disconnected. Because let's think about what happened with the Pharisees. So God lays down a command. And he says, you can't work on the Sabbath. When we hear that as people, the first thing I want to do is I want to define what that means. Right? Okay, I want to follow God's rules. He tells me that I can't work, but what's the definition of work? Imagine if this happened with us now in present time. We get a new law, a new rule from God, says you can't work. Well, I started out, what does that mean? I have a job that I work at, but I only work from this hour to this hour on these days. So if I'm not working at my job on the Sabbath, can I do a project at my house? Because I put up a fence that started April 1st this last year. Still not done. Good news. Still going on it. And I have worked harder at that fence than I have a lot of days at my job. I've been more physically tired, at least. I've bled almost as much. I've never lost a fingernail at my job. I have on this fence. So is that work? It's not my job. I'm not getting paid for it. So you see how this can get kind of confusing. So what do we need to do? Well, we would probably, in our setting, we'd go to our pastors. Our religious leaders, the guys that spend their full time studying this stuff, and we'd say, hey guys, what is actually work? What specifically is work? And what if my job makes me work on the Sabbath? My job, I work rotating shifts. And as I mentioned when I first got up here, I have to work on Sundays. So does that mean, does my job inherently now make me sin? Do I need to quit that job and find a different job that doesn't ever make me work on Sundays? Can Christians never work in restaurants or retail settings because the job makes them do something? Wouldn't we have these questions and we'd want to go to our religious leaders and say, hey guys, I don't know exactly what work is, but my goodness, I don't want to violate God's law. So help me understand God's law better. And if it was in our setting, we'd probably make a committee, right? God's law committee for working. And we would probably sit around, and I can imagine in our context, right, for our setting, it'd be me, Kyle, and Rob, and we'd probably go on some retreat. We'd have to take a couple days, and we'd sit around. Rob would have a stock of Red Bull and candy, okay? And we would be like, well, let's come up with what work is. We need to help our people follow God as best they can, so let's figure out what work is. What do you guys think? What is this? Is this work? What if you're not going to your job? What if it's a CrossFit workout? What if you need to exercise? Is exercise? And we would sit there, excuse me, and we would come up with a list of what we would say, well, this is probably what work is. So do you see where I'm going? That we look at the Pharisees and we see kind of the completion of a process and we go, man, those guys are German terrorists. They're awful. They're the worst thing ever. But if you start actually thinking through it critically, that's not how they started. They didn't start out saying, man, like, how can we just mess people's lives up? Let's come up with some good things. You see how there's this erosion that kind of carries us to a place that maybe we didn't really want to start at when we started the process. And God's kind of standing there going like, hey, guys, I said you needed to take a day and take a break. Now all of a sudden you don't know where you can spit. But that's where it takes us. So the Pharisees are the bad guys in the story, yes. But have you read much of the disciples? They're not good guys. We aren't passive observers sitting in a movie theater watching this happen. Keep in mind, when we read these stories, it feels disconnected because we don't get the culture. I'm guessing most of us in this room haven't threshed grain out. Probably haven't been around an ox. I thought I'd never be around livestock animals, but I am. And so it feels like super disconnected. But remember, the one thing that has never, ever changed is human nature. So how we process information is different now because of our culture a little bit, but it's kind of the same also. I feel confident that if we just got the Sabbath law now, there would be meetings and committees from Gospel Life, and then Gospel Life would put out some sort of literature, a post on the internet. We'd do something and say, hey guys, I know this is confusing. We're going to try to help clarify it for you. So this is what happens with the Pharisees. And then these rules kind of get passed down. This list starts getting passed down generation after generation. It probably gets added to, maybe subtracted from, because their culture shifts and changes a little bit. Maybe the list only started out with like five things when they first did it. But now here we are in Jesus' time, and there's 39 things that are considered work. And if you do them on the Sabbath, you're violating law. They saw what the disciples were doing. And in all honesty, they probably made a little bit of a stretch of threshing because they wanted to pick a fight. And they came and they picked a fight. But just remember, we're not passive observers. We are connected to this in a very significant way. So Jesus' response, he takes what they say, hey, your disciples are working. Keep in mind, he never says, no, they're not. So when he refutes the Pharisees, when he talks back to them and he gets in this conversation with them, he never once says, no. Let's actually look at the 39 lists, or the list of 39 things that are work, and I will tell you why my disciples didn't break any of these 39. He didn't do that. Instead, he referenced a story. He referenced a story about King David, which I'd like to look at, because once again, if it's important enough for Jesus to reference, it's probably important enough for us to take a look at. And it's in 1 Samuel, in chapter 21. So I think it's on the screen, and I'll read through it. Then David came to Nob, to Elimelech the priest. And Elimelech came to meet David, trembling, and said to him, why are you alone and no one with you? David said to Elimelech, priest, the king has charged me with a matter and said to me, let no one know anything of the matter about which I send you, with which I have charged you. I've made an appointment with the young men for such and such a place. Now then, what do you have on hand? He's referring to food. Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever is here. And the priest answered David, I have no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread. If the young men have kept themselves from women. And David answered the priest, truly, women have been kept from us always when I go on an expedition. The vessels of the young men are holy even when it is an ordinary journey. How much more today will their vessels be holy? So the priest gave him the holy bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, which is removed from before the Lord to be replaced by hot bread on the day it is taken away. So there's a lot just in that I won't. We're not going to dive into keeping yourself from women and being holy. That's not the point of that. But what's going on here is he goes into the temple, and there's another provision in the Old Testament where it talks about setting out bread, baking fresh loaves of bread, setting them on the altar as an offering to God. They stay there until the next day that it gets replaced, which, interestingly enough, do you know what day they would switch out the bread? The Sabbath. Kind of a strange connection. So on the Sabbath, they set out bread as an offering to God, and it stays there until the very next Sabbath when the priest switches out the bread with fresh bread. When they switch it out, the priests were allowed to eat that bread, but no one else was allowed to. In this scene that we see David, this is right on the heels, King Saul tried to kill him. King Saul's son, Jonathan, who was David's friend, warn David that he's going to try to kill you again. You got to get out of here. So David took a small little band of his buddies, and they ran. And they got out before the king could kill him. They didn't pack food. They didn't bring provisions. They didn't do any of that. They took off. So now he's coming to the temple. He's talking to the priest. The priest knows exactly who he is, and he's saying, I need food. I don't have food. And the priest, knowing that David isn't allowed by law to eat the bread, gave him the bread anyways. So what statement, what idea do you think Jesus is making with this story? Because it's not about the Sabbath. It's not about keeping the Sabbath at all. The only thing it has to do with the Sabbath is the fact that the bread got switched out on the Sabbath. So it seems a little bit like a random injection for Jesus to say, oh yeah? You're questioning me about the Sabbath? Let me tell you a story that has nothing to do with the Sabbath. See how you like that, buddy. It seems a little disconnected. So what statement do you guys think Jesus is making telling this story? Once again, here's a response. This one's kind of easy. What statement is Jesus making here? Or does he just suck at debate team? It's one of the two. He's making a statement, or he's bad at debate team. Which is it? Relationships are more important than the law. That seems to be a really strong statement he's making. David, who's called a man after God's own heart, he's looked at as the best king that God ever gave Israel. He was not chastised for what he did with him and his men. They needed food. The priest, at the time, the priest, knowing that people are more important than laws, violated a law. He's a priest. Typically, when you read the Old Testament, if they talk about someone violating the law, what's one of the common punishments? Getting hit with rocks until you die. That's a pretty common punishment for breaking laws. You get drug outside of the limits of the village, and people throw big rocks at you till you don't move anymore. Seems like a good motivation to keep laws. So the priest violates the law, knowing he's violating a law. He didn't accidentally stumble into that. He violates a law on purpose because David and his men need food, and that's the only food he has. Jesus is making a really strong statement. When we even think about why was the Sabbath law given, was it for the benefit of God or was it for the benefit of people? People. God took rest He didn't need rest. We need rest, both physical and emotional, like we talked about. God took it voluntarily. You will be forced to sleep. Your body will shut you down if you run far enough and hard enough. Your body will just say, I'm done. And it won't be voluntary, and you'll just fall asleep. If you have little kids, right, it's the best thing ever. When kids are fighting a nap, and they're like, I'm not falling asleep. Then they fall asleep in super weird, awkward positions, and then you laugh at them. Or no, you lovingly, like, carry them up to their bed so they can finish sleeping. Because their bodies will just quit, because that's how God made us. He made this law not for him. He made it knowing our limitations and what we need. So in Matthew chapter 12, you have our parallel passage. So this is, right, the Gospels overlap a lot with stories because it's some of the same guys writing the Gospels who are there seeing Jesus. And sometimes they include other things that the other ones don't. So in Matthew, this is the same story of walking through the field, the Pharisees questioning Jesus. One of the interesting things that Matthew includes that Mark doesn't is Jesus also, he talks about the story of David, but then he also quotes a verse from Hosea. And the verse is Hosea 6:6, and he says, if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. Which is probably the only time Jesus ever calls his disciples guiltless. Usually he makes fun of them because they're dense. But he's standing up for him to the Pharisees. So you've got the book of Hosea. If you've never read the book of Hosea, it's one of the minor prophets in the Old Testament. It's a rough book to read. So when we talk about, like, hey, you're called to be a missionary, and we talk about that a lot, you're called to your workplace, you're called to your neighbors, and in a lot of ways, a lot of those callings can be really pleasant, right? Like, I like where I live. I like the people I work with. Like, this is, hey, I can get on board with this. I'll be a missionary to these people. Hosea was called to marry a woman that would constantly cheat on him. Specifically, God tells him to marry a whore, and then your life will be an example of how Israel is with me. That's terrible. Like, that's when you say, I traded my job as a prophet. I'm going to go be a blacksmith or something. Like, I'm out. But that's his whole life. So the book of Hosea is this repetitive sequence of this guy and his wife being perpetually unfaithful to him, and then God saying, okay, go get your wife back from her new boyfriend and bring her back to you and continue loving her. Because Israel constantly runs away from me. I chase them down. I grab them. I bring them back to myself and wait for them to go cheat on me again so I can go chase them, pull them back to myself, and continue loving them. And the book talks about how the people of Israel were still sacrificing. They were making sacrifices, and they were doing these things, but their hearts were so far away from God. And I love this verse of 6:6. It shows God's heart, where you have all of the sacrificial system, and we can read through the laws, and man, it seems daunting. The animals you have to bring corresponding with the types of sins you're confessing to. It needs to be certain animals. They need to be pure. They need to be clean. That some of them have to be this old or that old. And man, it is intense. But here God says, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. In the midst of the Old Testament, where all these sacrifices are happening, he makes this strong statement of saying, you don't get it. The Pharisees have a law that God gave to be a benefit to people. And they robbed that benefit from people. Do the Pharisees seem pretty rested to you? I'll tell you what, trying to remember the 39 things that are work for me to say, oh, yay, it's my day of rest. But shoot, I have to spit. I need to go find some rocks really fast. To me, feels like a trip to Disneyland. So the question I have when I look at this and I start thinking through, God has given us so much, so many gifts that are meant to be a benefit. So the harder question is, what are the things in your life or your friend's life, if you don't want to talk about you, that's fine, that God has given to us to be a benefit, but you use them while it's robbed of that benefit. I'll give you one example to help you understand what I'm meaning. The Bible was given to us. It wasn't for God. God didn't write the Bible so he could remember all the stuff he did. The Bible is written to us so we could know what God is like, what we are like, and what he's done. Right, that's the Bible. It's now the end of December, getting to the end. You're thinking about Christmas, and right after Christmas, you're going to start thinking about your New Year's resolutions, right? You got 150 pounds you got to lose. You're going to work out every day, and probably what else is on that list? I need a yearly Bible reading plan, and this year, I'm going to make it past Exodus. It's going to be so good. I'm going to crush it this year. I'll make reminder cards. I'll put stuff on my bathroom mirror so I see it. And man, this year is going to be better because I feel really guilty about last year when I didn't make it. We've taken a love letter written from the King of the universe and we've broken it down to this guilt-ridden thing. Even how we study. I'll tell you that when I look at this, he never says, man, you better get a book that has the original language that I'm writing this down in, not even your language, and you should probably know a couple of the original language words, because that's how you really know what it says, and then you'd really be spiritual. You should also probably get a bunch of books written by other dudes that tell you what they thought about it when they read it, so then you can read it. If you ever got a love letter, would you ever like hand it off and say, hey man, read this and tell me what you think she said? That sounds really good. Thanks for reading it. I want it back. Sorry, no, commentaries aren't all bad, but it's still. We take this thing that God gifted to us, and we've turned it into a duty that has no joy. So what are the things that we see that God has given to us to be a benefit to us that we use in ways they weren't intended to be, that's robbed them of their joy? What are some others? Interaction. It can be something you've seen your friend do, right? We all got a friend that screws up a lot. It doesn't have to be you. Marriage. Was that given as a benefit? I think it was. Sorry, we're done with the marriage series. Marriage, given as a benefit. Right, I mean, they continue running numbers, but like half of all marriages end in divorce. Numbers the same inside the church as outside the church. Marriage and parenting are probably the hardest things you'll ever do. Marriage is given. Hey, I want to give you guys a picture of my relationship with you and what unconditional love means. And I want to give you this idea of my love for my people. Anyone feel like their marriage would be defined by that? I don't. Yeah, so our marriage. We take it, it's given as a benefit, and we use it in a way that's been robbed. What else? Time. What do you mean by time? Managing your time. Yeah, time's been given as a gift. A lot that we can do with it. We're stewards of our time, right? God's trusted us with time to do things with, and we can fiddle it away. Yeah. What else? What's that? I'm sorry, what? Friends, yeah. So community. Here's something that may shock you guys. And I'll give you a second to gather yourself after I tell you. We didn't come up with gospel communities.
What?
I know it feels that way. But we didn't. God set up the idea that we have to live life with other people. We have to live life in community surrounded by people. And so often we use that as a selfish way to serve our own desires, a selfish way for us to get what we need out of something, being in community, or just dreading it because we hate being around certain people, right? We use it in a way, it was given as this benefit to be life-giving, and we use it in a way that robs it of its benefit. Yeah. What else? Food? Yeah, I'll get to find it. So food? Yeah, food tastes super good. God, so I'll keep using movie references, right? So the Matrix, what do they eat? They like nasty porridge-looking stuff. I don't even know what that is. It looks disgusting. We could have done that. We're coming on the heels of Thanksgiving. I had a smoked turkey and a couple smoked ducks, and it tasted better than whatever I saw Neo eating in that porridge. God's given us this ability to taste things in ways that are amazing. And we use it as a way to comfort ourselves, to hide from things we're scared of, to hide our sin, right? We run to it as a way to make ourselves feel right. And we take the taste that God's given for us to enjoy life more, and we use it as a way to actually hide from God. Yeah, finances. What's crazy is God's given us finances to be used to care for ourselves and other people. Imagine if your finances were run by God and he just rationed out your entire budget. Do you think your budget would look different if God set your budget for you? If he just said, hey man, I got it, I'll set your budget, you just got to follow it. Do you think it'd look different than what you have written down? Yeah, probably. Children. Once again, has he given us children as a benefit? Yes, he has. Sorry, Faith, you're not usually in here. I'm sorry. So, given us children as a benefit, your joy. But how often, once again, do we use that for our own desires? My son just got done playing his first year of tackle football. I would go to some of those games, and I would feel bad that those other dads, whatever, got a crippling knee injury and couldn't go to the NFL like they were supposed to go to. And now it's their son's job to carry on their dynasty of 2 years of JV football and 1 year of varsity. There's a legacy, a mantle that needs picked up and carried on. And they're 10-year-olds. Children, given as a benefit, but what do we do? Once again, we are able to find our own way of taking our selfish desires and robbing the joy out of the gift that God has given us. Christmas time, if you have kids, how frustrating is it to give them this gift, they open it up and they play with the box, not the thing that costs like $50. Like, oh man, I'm so excited. This is gonna be perfect. She's gonna love it. It's gonna be so good. And then they use like the packing peanuts or something, like, oh, this is the best thing ever. It's like, no, you're playing with the wrong thing. What are you doing? What about prayer? What about church? God has given us a corporate gathering, not for him. God doesn't need us to sing the songs we sing. God doesn't need us to come together with other people that love him. God doesn't need us to listen to sermons. Corporate gathering is not given for God. It's given for us. But how often do we use our involvement at church for people to see how good we are? How often do we use the volunteer hours we put in to make ourselves feel right? Prayer. God has given us this gift that we have the ability to commune and talk to the creator of the universe. How often do we either neglect that or we pray in a way that we would never talk to anyone else? Like, does anyone pray and they start feeling like they're reading the King James Bible? Right? Have you ever heard that? It's like you start talking in a way, it's like, no one talks like that. What are you doing? Like, God isn't the King of England. Like, God just wants you to talk to him. The final statement in our text is pretty massive in Mark. We'll go back to that one because Jesus makes this last statement and it is massive. He says this. Let me get there. Sorry, I don't have red letter words, so I don't know what Jesus says. Okay, I found it. So he said to them, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath. He makes two bold statements. The first is about the law. He's saying the law was actually given for man's benefit. Imagine how you'd feel when you're doing your yearly Bible reading plan. And right, usually you make it pretty far. You hit like Leviticus, right? That's like eating cereal without milk. Right, that's tough. That's tough to get through. Because laws, by nature, we bristle up against. We either feel like we need to do the law to make ourselves feel better about ourselves, or we feel like we're living in oppression underneath the law. A lot of you guys know, right? I'm a police officer. My job is to enforce laws. What's funny to me is people argue and fight more about traffic infractions than when I find someone that actually has drugs in their pocket. You find someone with drugs in their pocket, they're like, yeah, all right, whatever, I'm under arrest. And a lot of times they don't even fight. You pull someone over for going 7 miles over the speed limit, oh my gosh, they erupt on you. We feel oppressed by laws. But why are there speed limits? Now, keep in mind, like, I'm not trying to make a campaign for SEMA, but why are speed limits there? Did somebody sit down and say, you know what? I bet what would really make people mad is if we make this road like 35 miles an hour. People would lose their minds. It'd be hilarious. No, they did math and smart people stuff to figure out what a safe speed to go on the road is to prevent what? Injury and death. Laws are given for the benefit of people in our culture. That's why they're given. They aren't given arbitrarily, no matter what we think about them. They're given for the benefit of other people. We see God's law. You read the book of Leviticus, you read any of those Old Testament books where there's just law after law after law. God is doing that for the people, not for himself. He's saying, this is how I want you to live because it's the best possible way for you to live. Knowing that we were incapable of fulfilling the law, but he's setting it down to say, this is the life I want you to have because it's better than what you see the other cultures doing. You have stories of people around the Israelites that are sacrificing their own children into fire. And God says, I'm going to take the time. There's passages about how and where to dig the hole you're going to poop in. That sounds weird to read through it in your Bible, but why? I don't know. Sanitation? Health? It's probably a better life if your poop's outside than sitting in your house. Probably, I don't know, but probably. So we see that these laws were actually made for our benefit. God says that man wasn't made to fulfill the Sabbath. I gave the Sabbath because I know my people and I know my children so well, I know you need rest or you will break. I even demonstrate taking rest, even though I'm unbreakable, for you to look at that and say, I need rest. The second statement he makes that's equally as massive is he's telling us his authority. He is making the proclamation that he is God. He's making the proclamation to the Pharisees that says, actually, you don't get to tell me how to interpret the Sabbath. I'm the one that made it. He's making this statement that says the Sabbath is actually fulfilled in me. So now our rest ultimately no longer comes from a day, no longer comes from a night of sleep, and no longer comes from a vacation, no matter what that is, and no matter how restful you think it'll be. Now Jesus is saying, I am the Sabbath. Which is why Gospel Life has not issued a list for you about what not to do to work on the Sabbath. We don't issue that out. We don't tell you, okay, guys, you can work on your car, but you can't work around your yard. We don't come down and find the minutiae of what work is. Why? Because what we say is, Jesus fulfilled it and the Sabbath is him. The rest comes from him. It doesn't come from taking a day to not work. We know that that's still a benefit to us because God set us up that way, but he's the Sabbath. And that's the statement he's making to the Pharisees here. Next week, we get to see another statement about healing. We see another example where Jesus is almost pleading with the Pharisees to understand that people are more important than the laws because the laws were made for the people. So we got to think about why God made the laws he made, and it should cry out to us and sing to us not only how intimately he knows us, but how amazingly he loves us, that he would do that for us. That it's not a burden. It's not a confined box. When we read through the Old Testament and say, oh man, I am so glad I don't live during those days. I'm going to skip ahead of this because this is all kind of pointless stuff. We can read that and say, man, God, you love the Israelites so much. You want them to have this life lived with you that's better than anyone else. And that's why he's setting those laws down. And we can also see the bold proclamation that he makes, that he says, I am the fulfillment of all those laws. Which, what does that mean? Jesus cares more about people than he does about laws. Communion, I saved on the list, because it's something else that we can use. Communion was given to us as a gift. Communion was given to us as a gift to remember, because I'm not good at remembering. Throughout the Old Testament, you have these events where something massive happens, and a lot of times God says, I want you to take a bunch of rocks and make a pile. And then when your kids walk by and say, why is that pile of rocks there? You tell them the story about what I did. Communion is another pile of rocks. It's another time for us to remember what God did for us. This wasn't just setting of another law. This was altering all of human history to fulfill the laws we couldn't fulfill, for the law to become a person, and for the law to become a relationship that cares far more about you and your heart than any law that you could try to keep. Let me pray for us.